pick up on the 10th chapter in the book of Daniel. And the 10th chapter is a very interesting chapter, albeit that the content of it may be kind of short, but it is very interesting because it gives us a look into the realm that exists that we might call the angelic realm, or the realm in which God's angels operate in. Daniel says, and we won't read it all word for word. I know that you can do that. Daniel begins this chapter by simply talking about that he's in the third year of Cyrus, king of Persia. Now, the Medo-Persian Empire has taken over from the Babylonian Empire, and this is the king now of the Medo-Persian Empire, Cyrus. He's in his third year of reign. Now, the time given for the commandment to go forth and to build Jerusalem, which we read about in the 9th chapter, in the previous chapter, dealt around 457 B.C. So we need to remember that this is somewhere right around that time frame. And what's interesting about that is that Daniel, in the next chapter, is going to give us prophecy, or God is going to give us prophecy, that is minute in its detail. So much minute that critics of the Bible and people who are critical of the book of Daniel want to surmise that Daniel wrote it after the fact, or that somebody else wrote it after the fact that these things transpired, because it is so accurate in its detail of it. But we know that God has given to Daniel a revelation. He's given to him a prophecy that pertains to his people. Daniel, in the 9th chapter, was concerned about the children of Israel returning back to Israel, back to their land, establishing the temple and worship of God again. And he's given that 490-year timeline, that 70 weeks. He now, in this third year in the reign of Cyrus, he is out and he's walking along, and the fourth verse says that it was in the 4th and 20th day of the first month, and I was by the side of the great river, which is Hiddekel. Now, that is the river Tigris. You got to remember, he's at Babylon, he's in Iraq, and he's walking by the river Tigris. A vision is going to come to him. The Bible, he's already said that he has not ate any pleasant bread, nor has any flesh or wine come into his mouth, and 3 whole weeks. So you got to figure Daniel has been fasting. He's pretty weak at this point. But the idea of him purging himself and the idea of him fasting is because he is concerned about his people. And he's still concerned about Israel, even though the timeline has been given to him that these things will come to pass. And, of course, the timeline even down to when Jesus Christ would come and be sacrificed upon the cross. So in the 5th verse, he says, "And I lifted up mine eyes and looked, and behold, a certain man." Now, he describes this man. He doesn't give his name, but he describes him in great detail. He says he's in linen, whose loins were girded with fine gold of Uphaz. His body was like the beryl, and his face as the appearance of lightning, and his eyes as lamps of fire, and his arms and his feet like in color to polished brass, and the voice of his words like the voice of a multitude. So he sees this vision, but the people with him do not. But they sense it in some way. And the Bible says there was a great quaking that fell upon them in the 7th verse. And in the 8th verse, they left him, and he was alone. But he had no strength in himself, he says in the 8th verse. And he says, "For my comeliness was turned in me into corruption, and I retained no strength. Yet heard I the voice of his words. And when I heard the voice of his words, then was I in a deep sleep on my face, and my face toward the ground." So the stage has been set for Daniel now to receive the prophecy that we're going to read about in chapter 11 and in chapter 12. We won't do both of them tonight, so don't have to worry. It won't be that long. The heavenly messenger, whoever this is. Now, some people have said that this was Jesus, and that Jesus followed. Of course, the Bible tells us that he was the rock that followed Israel in the Old Testament. It is understandable that Jesus did play a very active role in everything that happened with the Jews in the Old Testament time, but we don't know that for a fact. We're not given that detail. So, and we can't say exactly who this one is. this image that he sees is much like the image of Christ that's given to us over in the book of Revelation, though. So it is possible, but again, we're not given his name, so we don't know. We just know that he is a heavenly creature. The Bible says that a hand touched him in the 10th verse and set him upon his knees and the palms of his hands, and he told Daniel. Now, this is where it gets interesting in verse 11. And he said unto me, O Daniel, a man greatly beloved, understand the words that I speak unto thee, and stand upright. For unto thee am I now sent. And when he had spoken this word unto me, I stood trembling. Then said he unto me, Fear not, Daniel. For from the first day that thou didst set thine heart to understand, and to chasten thyself before thy God, thy words were heard, and I am come for thy words. But the prince of the kingdom of Persia withstood me 21 days. Now, Daniel's been fasting for 3 weeks. That's 21 days. So, Daniel, from the very beginning, when he decided that he wanted to know about what God's plans were for his people, from that very moment that he decided he wanted to know that, this individual says he was dispatched to go and tell him. However, he says he had been withstood by the prince of Persia. Now, who's the prince of the kingdom of Persia is looked upon as being the angel of Persia, and is looked upon as being the angel that is contrary to the work of God. So you had the devil and his angels who are working behind the scenes to cause things to happen, but you have God who is in direct, who's showing in control, showing and making things move in the direction that he wants them to go in. He says, he withstood me 21 days, but lo, Michael, one of the chief princes, came to help me, and I remained there with the kings of Persia. Now, Michael has always been looked upon as the angel of Israel, because he's the one who disputed over the body of Moses. You remember we read about that in the book of Jude. And he also is one that we see that follows with Israel many times. He's their champion. He's their angel that God has set to see over them. Now, I'm come to make thee understand what shall befall thy people in the latter days, for yet the vision is of many days, is for many days. And when he had spoken such words unto me, I set my face toward the ground, and I became dumb. And behold, one like the similitude of the sons of men touched my lips, and I opened my mouth and spake, and said unto him that stood before me, O my Lord, by the vision my sorrows are turned upon me, and I have retained no strength. For how can the servant of this my Lord talk with this my Lord? For as for me, straightway there remained no strength in me, neither is there breath left in me. Then there came again and touched me one like the appearance of a man, and he strengthened me, and said, O man greatly beloved, fear not, peace be unto thee, be strong, yea, be strong. And when he had spoken unto me, I was strengthened, and said, Let my Lord speak, for thou hast strengthened me. Then said he, Knowest thou wherefore I'm come unto thee? And now will I return to fight with the prince of Persia, and when I am gone forth, lo, the prince of Grecia shall come. But I will show thee that which is noted in the scripture of truth, and there is none that holdeth with me in these things but Michael, your prince. So this one that we do not know is here talking to Daniel. Now, throughout the scriptures, we don't exactly know everything that angels do. It is a subject that is shrouded in mystery. We know they're under God's control in the Old Testament. In the Old Testament, Jacob sees a ladder, and he sees angels ascending and descending from heaven. So in other words, he's given this message that God's angels are down here doing what God wants them to do. We remember when Elisha and the young man in there at the city of Dothan, and the army of Syria surrounds the city because the king of Syria wants to kill the prophet, because this prophet keeps telling the king of Israel every step that he's about to make. So he figures out what city he's in. He goes there. They surround it early morning. And when the prophet comes out, here's this army surrounded him. And the boy is, you remember, he's very worried about what he sees here. He's scared. And Elisha says, Lord, open his eyes that he may see that those that are with us are greater than those that are with them. And when the boy's eyes were open, the hills all around were covered with angels. And there was just an angelic force there ready to defend the prophet. You remember they smote the Syrian army with blindness, and they led them right over to
the king of Israel. And the king of Israel wanted to slay him, but was told, no, you wouldn't slay someone you invite into your house, so you send him down and you feed him. And the king of Syria went back, and of course he realized, I can't mess with this prophet, nor can I mess with the God of Israel. Jesus was here upon this earth, and of course Satan tempted him. One of the temptations was that cast yourself down from this high pinnacle. Isn't it written that you'll not even dash your foot upon a stone? That God's angels are going to bear thee up, they're going to take care of you. And so you can imagine the scene around Jesus that we couldn't see with our naked eye is the angels watching over every step he took, over every move that he made. Never was there ever a bone broken. Never was there ever any time in which he did dash his foot or he did fall down or anything of this nature happen. And the angels were carefully watching over him. So time and time again, we're told about these angels doing things behind the scenes that we have no seeing of. We cannot see them. Now here this angel's telling to Daniel that, look, these kingdoms that we've already talked about, we've talked about the Babylonian kingdom, the Medo-Persian kingdom, the Grecian kingdom, and then the Roman kingdom, these are all going to come about to pass. Now, they don't just by happenstance come about. There's things that are happening behind the scenes and influence that's causing these things to come about. Such as when Xerxes here, who we're going to find out and read in the next chapter, is the richest of all the Medo-Persian kings. He decided to extend his territory up into Greece, and he went and he invaded Greece. Well, Greece stopped him. He came back in defeat. This set up the for Greece actually to come together as an army, and then they themselves went about conquering the world. So everything that happened had an effect to it. Everything in history that we're going to see here, everything that went about something else caused something else to happen. And it didn't, as we said, just happen because it did. It happened because God wanted it to happen that way. We don't know all the ways of God, nor do we know all the power of God and the things that He does. But we know that He is in control. Things will go the way that God has decided for them to go. So Michael stood with this one who was going against the prince of Persia to cause Persia to do what they needed to do so that the next events could themselves unfold. Now, we come to chapter 11, and chapter 11 is a very, very busy chapter. And we're going to have to read this chapter, and it's got a lot that's going on with it. As a matter of fact, it's a very lengthy chapter. We may not even get through it tonight. But it's the detail of the history of the things that are about to unfold is just staggering to the mind when you think about it. Daniel says, also I in the first year of Darius the Mede, even I stood to confirm and to strengthen him. And now will I show thee the truth. Behold, there shall stand up yet three kings in Persia, and the fourth shall be far richer than they all, and by his strength, through his riches, he shall stir up all against the realm of Grecia. So now, he's under the rule of Cyrus, but there's going to be three more kings that's going to rise over the Medo-Persian Empire. How would anybody know that? How would anybody know that there would only be three more? Why not two more, five more, or however many? But God knows. And so Daniel's being told there's going to be three more kings over the Medo-Persian Empire. There's going to be Cambyses, there's going to be Darius, and there's going to be Xerxes. The third one is going to be richer than all the rest. That's Xerxes, and he was. He had wealth just about beyond compare. And he was far richer, and by his strength he went up and he stirred up Greece. Why is that important? Because Greece has to come on the scene next. The next empire that has been already shown in the second chapter, when Nebuchadnezzar has his vision of the image, the golden head being Babylon, the arms and the breasts being Medo-Persian, and the brass in the center of the statue being the Grecian Empire. So that's the one that has to come next. This is the one that Daniel sees in the visions, and he sees it as a ram with one horn that comes and strikes into the goat that has two horns, this one up here, and destroys it. So this has already been seen. It's the leopard that moves with speed that's already been depicted also in the book of Daniel here. So the Greek kingdom has to come. And so the Medo-Persian kingdom has to do something to cause this kingdom, this empire, to rise up. And what it is, Xerxes, as we said, he goes to Greece, he tries to conquer it, he's defeated. And now this mighty empire, the Medo-Persian empire, has a chink in its armor. The rest of the world knows that they're not invincible. The rest of the world knows that they can be defeated. And the Grecian military is about to come together in the form of something like 2 million men or and greater. And you can imagine a military like that, an army like that, marching out of Macedonia, out of Greece, and coming down through the rest of the world all the way over into India in a very short period of time. In verse 3 he says, "And a mighty king shall stand up and shall rule with great dominion and do according to his will." Now, that is Alexander the Great. Alexander the Great is the one who takes this great Greek military machine and begins to go forth and conquer the known world. Now he says, "And when he shall stand up, his kingdom shall be broken and shall be divided toward the four winds of heaven, and not to his posterity, nor according to his dominion which he ruled. For his kingdom shall be plucked up even for others beside those." So Alexander the Great goes, and for just a few short years, he conquers most of the known world all the way into India. He has this massive kingdom, but he has, basically, he doesn't have heirs that's going to take this kingdom over. He goes back to Babylon. It's in Babylon is where he dies at. He dies an untimely death. I think he's like 32 years old or something. He's a young man or 36. He's not very old. His campaign has only lasted for like 6-7 years. He's done all these things. He's done just exactly what the Bible's telling us, and now he dies in Babylon, of all places. Well, when he dies, then his kingdom gets broken up into four kingdoms. This is the four winds that's being talked about. Any of his descendants, and he did have a wife, and I'm not sure if he had one or he had two, all of them get killed. They all get put to death. And there's no one to stand up and say, "I'm now ruler of this kingdom." There's no offspring to do that. So what happens is the four generals that he had divided the kingdom up. And what they did was, one of them took Greece, that's the kingdom to the east. One of them took Asia Minor, the kingdom to the west. One of them took the kingdom to the north, which is Syria. And the other one took the kingdom of the south, which is Egypt. Now, a lot of this chapter deals with these two kingdoms, the north and the south. Why? Because Syria, this kingdom here, is the one that Israel is going to fall under rule of. And that's what Daniel's concern is. What's going to happen with Israel? So now we've been told that he dies, not to his posterity. Why? Because there was no offspring to take it. They were all assassinated. Nor was it according to his dominion, which he ruled. His kingdom's going to be plucked up, even as others beside those. And the king of the south shall be strong, and one of his princes, and he shall be strong above him, and have dominion. His dominion shall be a great dominion. Now he's talking about Ptolemy over here. Ptolemy was and there are many rulers. This is going on now for several hundred years. And to get into the detail of each and every king and each and every ruler, it would take quite a bit of time. So I'm going to try to cut through just a little bit of it. And I encourage you to go home and to read Daniel and to read it with commentaries about the history of what's transpiring here. But all this has to do with Israel. Every bit of it has to do with what's going to happen with God's people. So there's the king of the south. Now in verse 6 he says, "And in the end of years they shall join themselves together, for the king's daughter of the south," this was Bernice, "shall come to the king of the north to make an agreement, but she shall not retain the power of the arm, neither shall he stand nor his arm, but she shall be given up, and they that brought her, and he that begat her, and he that strengthened her in these times." So now they're talking about the king of the north here and the king of the south. Now they were always trying to get together to make one big army. remember, they may have divided up, but what does man want to do? What's he always want to do? He wants more than what he's got. He wants to conquer more. These two appear to be the richest of the two. This is where great riches were over there in Egypt. And these riches seem to pass from one place to the next place. One would go defeat another one. He would grab the riches, bring them back to Egypt. Now Egypt becomes the prize. Someone would go over there and conquer Egypt, take the riches back. And you can see this was just going back and forth and back and forth. But out of a branch of her roots shall one stand up in his estate, which shall come with an army, and shall enter into the fortress of the king of the north, and shall deal against them, and shall prevail, and shall also carry captives into Egypt, their gods, with their princes, and with their precious vessels of silver and of gold, and he shall continue more years than the king of the north. So, Ptolemy comes over here, conquers Syria. Now Syria has the gold, they have the riches that were seized from Egypt, they have the gods of Egypt. Historians say there was something like, and I want to remember, 3,500 different idols or something that they had. And they were all captured and brought back to Egypt. Egypt named him their benevolent. Now the reason he went back to Egypt and got out of Syria was he heard there was problems at home. Now you can see all these things work in such a way we would call mysterious. But there's reasons, and we know now from reading verse 10 what's behind all of these different things. In verse 9, so the king of the south shall come into his kingdom and shall return into his own land. But his son shall be stirred up and shall assemble a multitude of great forces, and one shall certainly come up and overflow and pass through. Then shall he return and be stirred up even to his fortress. Now, in the same way that Xerxes stirred up the Greeks, so Alexander the Great came, there's going to be a stirring up here in Syria that's going to cause Syria now to want to go back over here to Egypt and get what has been taken from them. And the king of the south shall be moved with choler and shall come forth and fight with him, even with the king of the north, and he shall set forth a great multitude, but the multitude shall be given into his hand. And when he hath taken away the multitude, his heart shall be lifted up, and he shall cast down many 10,000s. But he shall not be strengthened by it. For the king of the north shall return, and shall set forth a multitude greater than the former, and shall certainly come after certain years with a great army and with many riches. And in those times there shall many stand up against the king of the south. Also the robbers of thy people shall exalt themselves to establish the vision, but they shall fall. So the king of the north shall come and cast up a mount and take the most fenced cities, and the arms of the south shall not withstand, neither his chosen people, neither shall there be any strengthened to withstand. But he that cometh against him shall do according to his own will, and none shall stand before him, and he shall stand in the glorious land, now that's Israel, which by his hand shall be consumed. He shall also set his face to enter with the strength of his whole kingdom, and upright ones with him. Thus shall he do, and he shall give him the daughter of women. This is a woman who's named Cleopatra, corrupting her, but she shall not stand on his side. Now what's happening here is the king of the north at this time is giving to the king of the south Cleopatra to marry, that hoping that they would, of course, then come over here and cause a great union. But instead, she betrays her father, and she stays with her husband, which is the king over there in Egypt. Let's see here, verse 17. And he shall also set his face to enter with the strength of his whole kingdom and upright ones with him. Thus shall he do, and he shall give him the daughter of women, corrupting her, but she shall not stand on his side, neither be for him. After this shall he turn his face unto the isles, and shall take many, but a prince of his own behalf shall cause the reproach offered by him to cease without his own reproach. He shall cause it to turn upon him. Then he shall turn his face toward the ford of his own land, but he shall stumble and fall and not be found. Then shall stand up in his estate a raiser of taxes in the glory of the kingdom. But within few days he shall be destroyed, neither in anger nor in battle. And in his estate shall stand up a vile person, to whom they shall not give the honor of the kingdom, but he shall come in peaceably and obtain the kingdom by flatteries. And with the arms of a flood shall they be overflown from before him and shall be broken, yea, also the prince of the covenant. And after the league made with him, he shall work deceitfully, for he shall come up and shall become strong with a small people. He shall enter peaceably, even into the fattest places of the province. And he shall do that which what his fathers have not done, nor his fathers' fathers. He shall scatter among them the prey and spoil and riches, yea, and he shall forecast his devices against the strongholds, even for a time. And he shall stir up this power and his courage against the king of the south with a great army. And the king of the south shall be stirred up to battle with a very great and mighty army. But he shall not stand, for they shall forecast devices against him. Now I want to stop there just for a minute and back up. Verse 21 says, and in his estate shall stand a vile person. This is the one that the rest of this chapter really deals with. And I probably am not spelling this right. Let's see. I think there's another letter in there. And this is the fourth. And his name is Antiochus, who his father is one that we just read about. That was the king of the north that tried to make allegiance with Egypt, the kingdom of the south. Out of all this, this man comes along. His name's Antiochus. He takes the name of his father, Antiochus the Great. He is a vile person. Now, this chapter deals with his antics and deals with what he does. He is a horrible person, so to speak. And he leaves his mark upon history. This Antiochus gives himself the title of Epiphany. Now, Epiphany means God. So he gives himself the title that he is a God. He wants to go over there and conquer Egypt. And we talked about this a couple chapters before, where he's over there ready to take Egypt, and the Roman Empire comes to their defense. And the general of Rome comes out, you remember, and he tells him, Rome wants you to return back and leave Egypt alone. And we want your answer. And he's like, well, let me go back and think about this. Now, he's amassed a mighty army. He doesn't deserve, really, the position he's got. He's got it, as the Bible says, through flatteries. He's got it by deceitfulness. But nonetheless, he's become king of this empire of Syria. Well, that general of the Roman army got out a staff and he drew a circle right around old Antiochus. He says, I'll have your answer before you step out of this circle. In other words, we're not fooling around. You tell us you're either going home or all these ships out here has got these Roman soldiers on it. We're going to land and come after you. Well, he had no choice but to go home. But when he goes home, when he goes back to Syria, he turns his attention to Israel. And he does the most vile things that a man can think of. Whereas before, if Israel had been conquered, pretty much they were left alone in their religion. They may have been taxed. They may have had their riches taken from them. They may have been under domination. However, they were remained free for their worship. This man's going to change all this. Now, a lot of people say that he is the forerunner of what we read about in the book of Revelations. In other words, what he does physically to Israel is something that we see spiritually happens to the church in the book of Revelations. And I can see a great correlation there, and I think you can too if you look at all the events and the things that happen. What Antiochus does is he kills thousands of them, literally like 40,000. Takes 40,000, sells them into slavery. A lot of the Israelite people have become apostate. They've left their religion. They're on his side. So now not only do you have this vile leader that has this massive army who literally hates Israel, so much so that he's going to want to wipe them off the face of the earth. And history says that when he makes that comment, when he finally gets to that point to where he makes the comment that Israel's going to be annihilated, he is stricken with worms in his stomach and he dies. He is given a plague that happens within him that cannot be seen from outside. He dies in an agonizing death And as the Bible says, none come to his aid. Of course, he's created all this situation. But what he does, some things that are very horrific. We'll talk shortly about them. What he does is he decides that he wants to keep Israel from worshiping. So he defiles the temple. He goes in there, he sacrifices pigs, he spreads pigs' blood throughout the temple on the altar in different places. He sets up statues to their gods. He puts a garrison outside of the very temple itself. And if any man tries to come up the temple mound up there for worship, this garrison comes out and kills him, beats him back. He goes in town and village after village after village to take away anything that resembles them and how they are as a race of people who are under one God. He makes them sacrifice swine. He makes them sacrifice to his gods. He does everything he possibly can, or he kills them. Well, it's a vile situation. The man is just totally full of hatred towards the Jews. He just wants them really converted or wiped out. You got your choice. Well, he comes to an untimely death, which, of course, as we read. But before he does, the Maccabees, and there's a couple of books that some have incorporated in the Bible, and they're the books of the Maccabeans. And you might pick up one of those Bibles somewhere, and it has those books in it. And they're the exploits, or they're what the Maccabees do. The Maccabees is a family who's living up there in the hills, and they're just tired of all this stuff Antiochus is doing to the people of Israel. By their faith, they get together, they get an army together, and they go down, they defeat him, and they take back Jerusalem. He then wants to get a bigger army and go and take care of them, but as we said, he dies. You can read some of this as we begin here. In verse 24, he shall enter peaceably, even upon the fattest places of the province, and he shall do that which his fathers have not done, nor his fathers' fathers. We already talked about that, how he wanted to take away their right to their religion. 25, he says, and he shall stir up this power and his courage against the king of the south with a great army, and the king of the south shall be stirred up to battle with a very great and mighty army. But he shall not stand, for they shall forecast devices against him. Yea, they that feed of the portion of his meat shall destroy him, and his army shall overflow, and many shall fall down slain. And both these kings' hearts shall be to do mischief, and they shall speak lies, one table, but it shall not prosper. For yet the end shall be at the time appointed. Then shall he return into his land, and great riches of his heart shall be against the holy covenant, and he shall do exploits and return to his own land. And the time appointed he shall return and come toward the south, but it shall not be as the former or as the latter. For the ships of Chidom shall come against him. Therefore he shall be grieved and return and have indignation against the holy covenant. Now this is what we talked about where he was turned around. And he goes back over there and now his anger is going to be poured out on Israel. So shall he do. He shall even return and have intelligence with them that forsake the holy covenant. And arms shall stand on his part, and they shall pollute the sanctuary of strength, and shall take away the daily sacrifice, and they shall place the abomination that makes desolate. So he desolated the temple by, as we said, going in there and sacrificing pigs and setting up idols. And such as do wickedly against the covenant shall he corrupt by flatteries. But the people that do know their God shall be strong and do exploits. Here's the point. Why is Daniel being told this? He's being told this so that the people can be strengthened for what's about to happen. In other words, yes, you're going to go back to your land. Yes, you're going to have your temple back. But know this, there's going to be other kingdoms that are going to come. These kingdoms are going to fall. You're going to have this one king that's going to rise up, and he's a terror, and he's a vile person, and he's going to have his time. These things, we don't know why. But we know they're in God's plan. And the people can be strengthened knowing that the Bible has told them this is what's going to happen. God's already told it to them, just like Jesus told the people about in the 24th chapter of Matthew that the destruction of Jerusalem would be coming upon them. Verse 33, and they that understand among the people shall instruct many, yet they shall fall by the sword and by flame, by captivity, by spoil many days. Now when they shall fall, they shall be holden with a little help. But many shall cleave to them with flatteries. And some of them of understanding shall fall to try them and to purge and to make them white even to the time of the end, because it is yet for a time appointed. And the king shall do according to his will, and he shall exalt himself and magnify himself above every god, and shall speak marvelous things against the God of gods, and shall prosper till the indignation be accomplished, for that is the determined shall be done. When we get into the next chapter, there will be three dates that are dealt with, and of course, there is the 1260, 1290, 1335. These times that are going to be talked about are these times that deal here with Antiochus Epiphany. Notice what it says here. He will do according to his will. He'll exalt himself and magnify himself above every god. This is what he does by taking the title Epiphany. He thinks he is a god. He thinks that he's just a god. He's a god, and he's going to do great things. Verse 37, neither shall he regard the gods of his fathers, nor the desire of women, nor regard any god, for he shall magnify himself above all. The man's literally mad, you might say. But in his estate shall he honor the God of forces, and a God whom his fathers knew not shall he honor with gold and silver and with precious stones and pleasant things. Thus shall he do in the most strongholds with a strange God whom he shall acknowledge and increase with glory, and he shall cause them to rule over many and shall divide the land for gain. And at the time of the end shall the king of the south push at him, and the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind with chariots and with horsemen and with many ships. And he shall enter into the countries and shall overflow and pass over. He shall enter also into the glorious land, and many countries shall be overthrown. But these shall escape out of his hand, even Edom and Moab and the chief of the children of Ammon. He shall stretch forth his hand also upon the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. But he shall have power over the treasures of gold and of silver and over the precious things of Egypt, and the Libyans and the Ethiopians shall be at his steps. But tidings out of the east and out of the north shall trouble him. Therefore he shall go forth with great fury to destroy and utterly to make away many. And he shall plant the tabernacles of his palace between the seas and the glorious holy mountain. Yet he shall come to his end, and none shall help him. So these are the exploits of Antiochus Epiphany the Fourth, as we just talked about. He sets himself up as a god. He tries to destroy the worship of the one true God in Israel. There is a time allotted that God gives him. Again, we don't know all the things that are in God's plan, nor why God does the things he does. His ways are higher than our ways, the heavens are higher than the earth. But the time that Israel went through with this man was a very tough time. He was indeed a monster, and he did horrible things, but he did come to an end. All the things that he did gave way and gave position to what was about to come. And of course, that's the Roman army. That's the Roman Empire. All these exploits that we read about of these two fighting among each other back and forth and back and forth bring about the rise of the Roman Empire in that area and the defeat of the armies that they had of the king of the north and the king of the south. I hope we have covered that. There's much more we could say about it. There's a lot we could talk about. And indeed, we may have to go back and cover some more of that. But in looking at it, just remember that Daniel is being told what's going to come upon his people. He's already been told about the 490 years. Now he's given a snapshot of what transpires during or previously to the coming of Jesus Christ during this 490 years. These are the things that transpire. These are the kingdoms of the world. And that they're going to rise and they're going to fall. But there's a kingdom God's going to establish that's never going to fall. And it will always remain and it will always be there. And that's the idea that's being posed to him and given to Daniel, that the children of God will be victorious because they're on God's side. At this time, we'll stand and we'll be dismissed in a word of prayer.